So, question, have you ever, have you ever gotten angry? No one? What? A couple of you? I mean, it's not just angry, like in the sense, I'm a little upset, you know, but I'm talking about the kind of anger where you feel that your body begins to tremble, you know, like you literally feel like you're shaking because you're so angry. You ever get angry like that? You ever get so angry like you're ready to tear the face off of someone angry? No, we would never say that, you know, here in church, right? You ever get so angry that you're ready to rip the door off of its hinges to get at the child who has just disrespected you? Yeah. Do you ever get so angry where you are ready to put a hole in the wall because you just don't know what else to hit or destroy? Yeah, me either. This morning, what we're going to find is this story, this sequence in which Jesus Christ gets angry. There's several situations in the scripture that we read about where Jesus does display his anger, and we see oftentimes, you know, the wrath of God. We can relate to that when we look at the Old Testament. If you read through the Old Testament, you'll see many cases where you see God express his anger, and we see that less often in the New Testament. It happens, it's there, but it's less often. You'll see it in the New Testament, particularly in Revelation, where God finally takes his wrath, and it says he pours out his wrath like bowls of wrath. And it's just, I mean, it's kind of a gruesome sight, and maybe someday we'll get into that. But in the Old Testament, you know, you think of different times where people got angry. You think of Potiphar. Remember the story of Potiphar? And he had, Joseph was his servant. Well, Potiphar's wife tries to trick Joseph in getting him to go to bed with her, and he says, no, I won't do that. And so she tricks Potiphar, her husband, into believing that Joseph had done it. And it says in the scripture, it says Potiphar burned with anger. We find times like the burning bush. Remember when Moses was encountering God at the burning bush, and God is telling to Moses, I need you to go to Egypt, and Moses is saying, I got this excuse, and finally he says, I'm not a real good speaker. The scripture actually says that God burned with anger towards Moses, and we don't oftentimes see that. You know, we see Moses like, well, he had kind of everything together. God wasn't really ever angry with him. Well, in this case, it says he burned with anger, and he says, fine, Aaron's a good speaker, he'll go with you. We see times when God expresses anger when the Israelites at the base of Mount Sinai, while Moses is up on the mountain for days after days, the people at the base of Mount Sinai says, well, maybe God isn't really there. Maybe he's left us. And so they create for themselves, they collect all their gold, and they create that golden calf. Moses comes down, and Moses was angry, and it says that God's anger burned against Israel that day as well. So this morning we're going to look at Jesus, and he's going to get angry. But I want to ask you the question, so we think of the times when we have been upset, we have been literally angry. Some people like to use the word mad, some people don't like to use the word mad. I think we could be, in a sense, mad with anger. I mean, really. But we pretend, honestly, we pretend like we don't get angry. You know, certainly we understand that we get upset sometimes, but for the most part, we kind of just hold on to this like, well, I really don't ever get that upset. I don't get that angry. And we kind of pretend that we downplay it a little bit. My grandfather, I never saw him angry, but I was convinced that he must have gotten mad at some point. So this last week, I had a conversation with my dad. I said, Dad, I want to know, when was Grandpa ever angry with you? You know, I mean, like, when was he ever mad? When did he ever, like, you know, this, some people don't agree with this, but tough, it was a reality in life. When did you ever get the wooden spoon? You know, what did you ever do? And my dad, he said, never. I'm thinking, what? I said, I can't believe that. And so I pressed him on. I said, there had to be something. He had to get mad at you sometime. No. And here's the thing with my dad. He was a fan of the wooden spoon when it wasn't on his bottom. You know, and so I felt the wrath of my father on a number of occasions. And so I had to ask him. I said, well, okay, let's back up here now. I know what it was like to get that kind of punishment. You never had that punishment. Where did that come from? You know, really, because you didn't just make it up all of a sudden. He said, well, it was his mom, you know. And I hardly knew my grandmother. But anyway, my grandpa didn't get upset very often at all. My dad told one story where he was standing at the pickup, you know, and he had a hammer in his hand, and there was the rear pickup window, and my dad said, I just remember looking at this window and looking at the hammer and wondering, I wonder how hard you'd have to hit it in order for that window to break. And so he's kind of studied it, and he said, So I hit it, and it shattered. And his answer was, not very hard. And even in that, he just describes my grandpa's reaction was more disgust than it even was anger. But I think my grandpa was kind of an exception to the rule, because I think, honestly, if we're really going to be honest, we have this reality where anger kind of festers. If you're a parent, I don't know how you can live your life without being angry at some point. You know, because as a parent, you're dealing with things like children ignoring you. You're dealing with things like disrespect. And when those things happen, just like flips a switch sometimes. And you find yourself, I just want to choke you. Not you. This is hypotheticals. You know, I would never say that to their face. You know. You know, but maybe it's something that's more subtle. You know, some of us have quirks and things like that, where if the toothpaste isn't rolled from the bottom of the tube, or if your toilet seat is left up, those are things that kind of throw us off. Maybe it's our children saying yuck to whatever I tried to cook for supper. Maybe what makes you angry is when the dog decides to poop on the carpet. Yeah, or pee on the carpet. Or when the dog decides to pee on the alpha male in the house while he's standing on the carpet. Yeah, it does happen, let me tell you. What about politics? Does politics make you angry? Maybe just depresses you, whatever the case is. But the reality of it is, if we're going to be honest, there's going to be a piece of us that can relate a little bit to what Jesus experiences today. However, as we get into it, I want you to pay special attention to what it is that triggers Christ's anger, because there's something there that is very important for us to recognize. It's very important for us to see, because I think what makes Jesus angry and what makes us angry a lot of times are quite vastly different things. Because I would challenge us to think, okay, does hunger make you angry? And I don't mean just like when you are hungry, are you angry? But more this idea of there's people out there who you see and it's like they got nothing. Does that kind of injustice make you angry? Does sex trafficking make you angry? You know, because we don't necessarily experience it here in this community, but it's a reality that we face in this world if we're willing to open our eyes and see it. But does that kind of stuff make you angry? Do you get upset when you see it? Because there are injustices in this world that should be upsetting to us. And sometimes, myself included, we'd like to, you know, kind of close our eyes, turn a blind eye to some of those things because, quite frankly, I don't want to be angry. I don't want to deal with it. And so instead of recognizing it, we turn it back to it. And Jesus won't do that, is what we're going to see here this morning. So last week, we encountered Jesus. He was at a wedding. His mom was there. He was with his disciples, and he turned this water into wine. Could you imagine if we could market that? You know, wow, we'd have this building paid off in no time. You know what I'm saying? But we see Jesus, we saw it last week, we saw Jesus give, and he gave generously, okay? So they ran out of wine at this wedding, and Jesus takes water and he turns it into wine, and it's not just a little bit, but he turns gallons upon gallons of, so 6 jars of 20 to 30 gallon jars, and he turns it all from water into wine. And not only was it a lot of it, not this huge quantity, but it was the quality of it that they talked about. It was just like it was the best that they had yet at the wedding. And then we challenged ourselves, we challenged it with the scripture, it's what is keeping us from accepting that kind of gift, that kind of generosity that Jesus Christ has for us? What is it that is preventing us from accepting the grace of Jesus Christ? And I want to emphasize again this morning that no matter where you are at, it's not too late. You know, in other words, no matter what you have done, okay, you're not a lost cause. I think that's really important to emphasize. Because you see that in the life of Christ, you see that in his ministry. Oftentimes, I am convinced that the enemy wants us to be convinced that when we have made the same mistake over and over and over again, that's it. That's a lost cause. There's no more grace left. I've already repented of it too often. And that, in the scripture, that is not the case. Jesus challenged his disciples, and he sent them out, you know, and he says, when someone has wronged you, you're going to forgive them. You know, well, how many times should we, like, go back? How many times should we forgive people? Up to 7 times, thinking, like, that was really generous. And he says, no, 70 times 7. And yes, it's a concrete number, but really what he's saying is, it's infinite. And that's a reflection of what Jesus Christ does for us. He'll forgive us over and over and over. And that's the idea that we were communicating last week. It's this grace upon grace upon grace. So we're going to get into it this week. And I'm super excited because I feel like what we're going to see here is it's a story that maybe many of us are familiar with. But I hope you see it in a new light. Because I felt like I saw it in the light. And there's a couple pieces here in particular that I was just really enlightened to. And I thought was wonderful. But we're going to, a couple of introductory verses. So we left off at verse 11 last week. Verses 12 and 13 are pretty much introductory, but it gives you an idea of what's going on here. So Jesus was at the wedding. He was at the wedding in Cana. Cana, if you know where the Sea of Galilee is, we'll say it's here. Cana would be about down here. Okay, Capernaum is like up here, so it's actually a little bit northward. But it says he went down to Capernaum. I know that doesn't go well with our map, you know, reading skills. However, because Capernaum was down by the lake, it was actually literally downhill. And so that's where this comes from. So after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers. Yes, Jesus had brothers. He probably also had sisters. Maybe you weren't aware of that, but that is a reality. One of his brothers, in fact, was named James. And James has a book in the Bible we'll get to sometime in the future. And his disciples, and there they stayed for a few days. Then verse 13, and this is going to kind of build into where we're going here today. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Again, Jerusalem would have been farther south and to the west. However, it was uphill from where they were at, so he actually is going literally up in elevation to Jerusalem. But what's going on here? It's almost time for the Passover. In other words, what would happen is, during this build-up, Passover's coming, they knew the date, and when that would build up, they're like, all right, we better start making that trek to Jerusalem. And so ahead of this celebration, it's not like, oh, tomorrow's Passover, we better get going. It was a lead-in, it was this build-up. Passover's coming, there was this anticipation, and so in anticipation for the Passover, they moved to Jerusalem, because when you go to Jerusalem, that is where the celebration Passover is. Jesus, during his ministry, engages in four Passovers. This is the first one. If you're not familiar with what the Passover is, it goes back into the Old Testament when Moses is leading, God is taking his people out of Egypt. They have these 10 plagues, and that 10th plague is this idea of, if you do what I say, I will pass over you and I will spare you. But what happens, God makes this plague, he makes this promise, he says, if you don't do this, I'm going to take the firstborn of every family. And so he lays it out for the Jews. This is what you're supposed to do. We find it in Exodus chapter 12. He says, you need to find a lamb. It needs to be a spotless lamb. And that's important to note, because as we go on today, it needs to be a spotless lamb. It needs to be a year old. And so there's certain regulations. In other words, it's got to be that's about prime. Your prime spotless lamb would have been a one-year-old lamb. It's about the best you could get. And you need to sacrifice that animal. And then you need to take the blood and spread it over the doorpost. And when the angel of death, if you will, comes over, he's going to pass over that home. And what happened was, is the Israelites did what God had said, and they were spared. And then Egypt, they just had this huge plague of death. And Pharaoh says, get out of here. Get. And so Israel, Moses leads the people out of Egypt, and they have celebrated the Passover ever since for thousands of years now. And so here's Jesus going down to Jerusalem to celebrate this Passover. I said down because it's south. It's up. Going down to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, this anticipation. And this is what we're going to be engaging in here today, because watch what Jesus encounters. Recall when we talked a few weeks back when John the Baptist sees Jesus Christ, he says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. They would be coming to sacrifice the lamb. This is all just this build-up into Jesus' ministry. So here's where we go. Exodus 19. You will be for me. So this is important to note. This is where God has set aside his people to be someone, to be a nation that points people back to him. We talked about that about a year ago. Remember that? We dealt with some of these scriptures. It's important to note right now because of what Jesus is going to encounter. So in Exodus 19, God says to his people, the Israelites, he says, you will be for me a kingdom of priests. A priest weren't just someone that just kind of followed God and listened to God and obeyed God. They were intended to help people to know God. They helped people to lead him to God. They would be that mediary, if you will, in this communication from God to the people and the people to God. Okay? So they had this role to help get people to in relationship to know God. And a holy nation. These are the words that you are to speak to the Israelites. And then we see Peter quote this in his letter in 1 Peter chapter 2. He says, but you, talking about the believers in Jesus Christ now. He says, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. It's the same theme that we have there. But go see where Peter goes with this. God's special possession that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of the darkness and into his wonderful light. So the Israelites had this role that their job was to declare who God was to the nations. You know, they talk about it for Abraham, and it's so important to note. I know it sounds like, well, this isn't going anywhere we're going. This is actually super foundational. You gotta understand this. Abraham was promised by God that you will be a great nation and that all nations will be blessed by you. All right, and this is where we see that kind of come to fruition, where it says, we now will declare the praises of him, praises of God who called us out of darkness into the wonderful light. We have this role. We have this job, and our job is to point people to Jesus Christ. The Israelites had a role by which they were supposed to point the nations back to God. But now watch what Jesus comes into in verse 14. So Jesus comes into Jerusalem. He's got his disciples there. They're coming in for the Passover. They're going to celebrate this Passover, okay? Where what would happen is these people would travel long distances, just like Jesus had from Capernaum, quite a distance down to Jerusalem. People are traveling all over to come to Jerusalem. Many of them would be bringing their sacrifices with them, all right? They would have raised this sacrifice, sometimes a lamb. They could have been a goat. And some poorer communities, we're going to see this, where they would bring whatever they had. Sometimes it was a dove. They would bring what they had to present it as a sacrifice, you know? And in some cases, those animals, if they had to travel a long distance, those animals wouldn't make it, you know? Or they would at least be much more disheveled, is maybe the word to use. In other words, they looked pretty bad by the time they got to Jerusalem. And it's important to note because of some of the details we're going to look at. So in the temple courts, Jesus comes. As he enters the temple courts, he finds people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. This, my friends, is serious. Okay, look at this. This is the New Testament temple. This is Herod's temple. This began to be built in roughly 20 BC, and it was finished roughly, I want to say, 62 AD. The year that this was taking place, no, yes, I think that's right, 62 AD. The year that this was taking place would have been roughly 26 AD. All right, so 46 years into the building of this temple. So this is what we have here. Jesus would have been coming in here, okay, through the gates. This is the Gentile courtyard. This is the Israelite, or the women's courtyard of the Israelites. This is the Israelite courtyard up here. This is the temple, and inside the temple we have this. And so only the priests could go in here, and only the high priest could go in there about once a year. And so there's these different stages of the temple as to where people could go. But this outer part here, this Gentile courtyard, this is where Jesus comes into, and that's where we see in the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. The reason that this is such an issue is that this is the only place that the Gentiles were allowed to be, which they could make the choice to seek God. They weren't allowed any further. And so the only place that the Gentiles could come in any kind of hope, because there was Gentiles who believed in the God of Israel. That was the case. And we saw it way back, actually, if you paid attention, we saw it way back when the Israelites left Egypt. There was a bunch of people, Egyptians, that went with them because this nation of Israel was designed to be a hope. It was designed to be someone that pointed people to God. And here we have, this is the temple. This is the temple that the Israelites are supposed to use to point people to God. Jesus walks in, and what does he find? He finds Israelites selling sacrifices. And so what was happening is this. So we have these people, they're bringing sacrifices. All right, and they go up to these Levites. These Levites were a priestly group. Okay, so from Levi, he was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. He was kind of assigned to be the priests, if you will. From all the priests would come from the Levites, and so he had these Levites there, and they're selling sacrifices because it wasn't uncommon. Someone would come to the Passover, and they would need to buy a sacrifice. They needed to have something to offer up to God. They didn't have anything, so they would buy it. In some cases, you'd bring the animal, and the animal would die on the way. Well, you had to have something to sacrifice, and so you have to buy one there. That wasn't necessarily uncommon of a reality, where they would make available to people who needed to have something to sacrifice. But what was happening is, let's say you're bringing your best lamb. This is what you got. It's spotless. That's what it said in Exodus 12. We're supposed to bring our spotless one-year-old lamb. This is what I've got. I've raised this lamb for the last year. I'm ready to sacrifice it. You present it to the Levite, and the Levite would look at it and say, I'm sorry, that one's not good enough. But I'll tell you what, you can upgrade to this lamb right here for such and such amount of dollars. And so then the people would have no choice. They had them over a barrel, if you will, had no choice because they had to have something to sacrifice. And so then they would take the lamb that was being sold to them at an exorbitant amount of money. They would leave the other lamb, and the Levites would take the other lamb and turn around and sell it to the next guy who's coming in with a lamb that's unacceptable, even though it might have been just totally fine. And these people are taking this place that is intended to point to God, and they're turning it into a mockery. Even in the book of Mark, Jesus refers to it as a den of thieves. It's a bunch of people robbing, not only God, but robbing the people. And it even says that they were selling doves at one point. And that's interesting to note, because the doves were set aside specifically for those who couldn't afford. You know, this is the thing. Way back in the Old Testament, you look it up in Leviticus. So this sacrificial system, I know we don't fully grasp it, we don't get it, I get that, okay? But even back in Leviticus, you see all these rules and you kind of think like, man, well, I can't make all those rules. God even made a way in Leviticus. If you couldn't afford it, God had a way by which you could take a dove, which was very cheap, and you could sacrifice the dove. If you couldn't afford anything else, he made a way by which you could engage and worship him, whether you had the economic means or not. In other words, you didn't have to be high and lofty to do it. You could be the poorest person in the world, and God made a way by which you can engage and worship him and be part of that sacrifice. And yet what these people have done is they've taken what God does and make ways, and they've shut the door. They've shut the door to the Gentiles. They've shut the door to even some of the Israelites. They would put on this temple tax, which is something you find in the Old Testament as well, but it's not necessarily called a tax, but it was something intended as another way to sacrifice, another way to offering. But they would take and they would charge these poor people 2 to 3 years' wages, in some cases, just to present their sacrifice. How can you afford that? You know? And so Jesus comes in, and this is what he encounters. This place where only the Gentiles could come, these people that he loves, and yet the Israelites certainly, there was polarizing, I get that, but Jesus comes in and he sees this. Oh, that's not so bad. Oh, that's good. He is so angry because everything that was intended to point to God is pointing at nothing but themselves. They're getting rich, they're greedy, they're selfish, and they just totally missed the point. Of way back in Exodus where it says you will be a holy nation. You will be a nation that will point people to God. You will be a nation that will bless nations. You know, and we look at it in Peter, how we are to declare the praises of God. There's no praising of God here. There's no declaration of the praising of God here. And Jesus comes in and he's mad. He's angry. It's a righteous anger because there's a major injustice going on. People, poor people, are being exploited. They're being abused. And they're left with, I mean, what kind of picture of God does that send? God is a God of rules. And if I don't follow these rules, well, this Levite said, I don't have the right stuff. And they're turning God into a mockery. Not only his house into a mockery, but they're turning God into a mockery. And so watch how Jesus responds here. He says, he makes a whip out of cords. It's like you can hear the Indiana Jones music stirred up, you know? And so here the story builds, and it kind of, here's Jesus, and he makes his whip. You can just tell in his anger, he takes the whip and he clears this temple. You know, this will not happen. I will not tolerate these injustices. This place is designed to point people to God. It is not designed for you to make a profit out of. And so he clears the temple of both sheep and cattle. He scatters the coins of the money, and the money changers turns over their tables. I mean, this is, you know, sometimes we think of Jesus as being like, oh, he's always so calm. There's times where Jesus Christ got angry. He got righteously angry, and he let it show. and that was okay. In verse 16, to those who sold doves, we talked about that, get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market. And there's stronger words, like I said, when we look at Matthew and Mark, where it says, literally, you've turned this into a place of robbers. You are nothing but thieves taking from the people that are trying to connect and worship God. His disciples, during this time, they remembered what was written. This is in Psalm 69, verse 9. It says, his disciples remembered that it is written, zeal for your house will consume me. And that's a prophecy of Jesus Christ, that he's going to be so zealous for God's house and what happens there and how God's house, how the church, how the temple was designed to point people back to God. He's going to be so passionate about it. He will not tolerate anything else. And then in verse 18, it says, the Jews, I love this. This is my favorite sequence here. I want you to grasp what Jesus' response in particular. In verse 18, it says, the Jews then responded to him, okay? So you have the Jews, they're selling these sacrifices, they're taking this temple tax. Here comes Jesus, and he clears the temple. He's mad, oh, this guy's upset. Here's the thing, we're making money here. I don't know that I'm okay with Jesus. I'm not just going to sit down and roll over just for the sake of this guy named Jesus is coming in. And so they challenge Jesus, and this is what they say. The Jews then responded to him, what sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? In other words, you know, this would have been the perfect time if Jesus would have had a business card. And he could have pulled it out, you know, oh, let me show you my card. Let me show you why, which authority. And all it says, one word, it says God. Okay? Let me show you. What authority do you have? Well, I'm God. But this is magnificent. So the Jews are asking, what sign can you give us? No, they've heard that Jesus has done some miracles, okay? They haven't gone quietly. We've only had, in the Gospel of John, we've only had one accounted for, and that was the water being turned into wine. However, it also has said that he did many other miracles along the way. It's just what John has recorded. So he is known for having these signs, all right? And what we have here, so the Jews are saying, well, what sign can you give us? Prove that you all, you know, have authority to basically determine what's going to happen and not happen. This is the best response ever. Jesus answered them, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. In other words, you want a sign? I'll give you a sign. You want a miracle? I will give you a miracle. Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. And these people, and we're going to see it, they think that he's talking about the literal temple, but that's not what Jesus is talking about. Instead, Jesus is talking about himself. So in other words, what Jesus is really saying is, kill me. You want a sign? Kill me, destroy me, and I will raise from the dead. Destroy me, and I will resurrect and be alive again. You want a sign? How is that for a sign? You want to know my authority? Kill me and watch me continue to live. Sorry, there's nothing much that can trump that. You know what I'm saying? Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. I love the in your face, and they're so clueless about it. But Jesus says, that's the best sign I'm going to give you. And by the end of this gospel, we're going to see that sign come to fruition where Jesus Christ will be killed, dead, buried, and he will rise again. And there's your sign that he had authority to do what it is that he did. I love it. Absolutely wonderful. So if you're here this morning, and you're questioning this idea, all right, Jesus, who are you? Are you alive? Are you real? We've been given a sign. Jesus Christ did die. He was dead, he was buried, and he rose again. And the people that wrote these documents that we're reading now saw it. John, the gospel writer, he was with Jesus during his ministry. He was there when we just read these scriptures. He wrote down this account because he was there. He saw Jesus at the cross die. He saw Jesus being buried. He went to the empty tomb. He saw that the tomb was empty, and he saw Jesus then alive later. We have someone who saw all of these things happen, and he wrote it down, emphasizing this sign. If you're looking for a sign, you've been given one. You know, I don't know what you're wrestling with here this morning, but if you're looking like, oh, Jesus, I just need to know, are you real? You've been given a sign. We just read through it. Oops, I went too far. Here we go. The Jews then reply, of course, because they can't just let that go without a reply. They said, it's taken 46 years, and that's what I touched on. The temple began to be built in about 20 BC, and it's roughly 26 AD, they believe, when this took place. So 46 years, but the temple wasn't finished until roughly 62 is what comes to my mind.
So what that means is this temple basically, when it says it took 46 years to build, it's up to this point is where they're really at. So they replied, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days. But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. And verse 23, and this is kind of ends the same way that last week's passage did. It says, now while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing, and they believed in his name. Everything that Jesus is doing is pointing to his purpose, what it is that he's after, the fact that he is moving towards the cross. He will be killed, he will be dead, he will be buried, and he will raise again. Everything that he's doing is for that purpose. So as we conclude, I want to kind of reflect and challenge us on kind of three questions. Where do you fit in this journey? Because we have this idea, we have this journey of people, and they're making their way to the Passover, they're making their way into Jerusalem. Where do you fit? Are you looking for Jesus? You know, because many of those Gentiles would have been making their way to Jerusalem to kind of investigate and wonder, all right, who is this God of Israel? You know, I've heard so much about him for centuries now. Who is this God? Are you looking for Jesus? Are you looking for something that maybe God has? And maybe that's the case, and you've come to, whether it's this church or another church, and you've kind of encountered something really sour. You've encountered people who kind of aren't pointing to God at all. If that's been your experience, I am so sorry for that. Because that is not what God's intention is for the church. That is not what God's intention is for his people. God's intention for his people is to be a people that point people to him. And if you've come and you've been felt like you've been judged, or you have been judged, if you've come and you just feel like, wow, that was terrible, I'm so sorry that that's been your experience. But I want to challenge you and encourage you that with God's intention, when you come close to him, when you enter into his courts, when you enter into his church and his temple, it's designed to be a place that points to him. You know, which brings us to the next question then. Are you here in such a way where, I mean, is your life pointing people to Christ? That's a reflection piece. You know, for many of us who have said yes to Christ, you know, we kind of get distracted. That's a reality. But is your life, are you living your life in such a way that you're pointing people to Christ? Because that was the call for the nation of Israel. That was what the call for the believers we read in 1 Peter. That's the call for us, is to be in a position where we're pointing people to Christ. You know, our goes so countercultural, because our culture really tries to emphasize, well, it's pointed back to yourself. It's really about you. So are you here? Are you seeking the Lord? Are you here? Are you pointing people to Christ? And the third question that I want to emphasize is, are you here to worship? Is that why you come? Are you here to worship? That's what the people were called to do. When we look at this temple, when Jesus entered into this temple for the Passover, I mean, this is the time where everyone's worshiping God, because what he did, that celebration of Passover, what he did thousands of years ago, and what Jesus finds is not worship. So are you coming to worship? Are you coming to set aside our own selfishness? Are you coming to set aside our own agenda? Like these Levites came obviously with their own selfishness, their own agenda. Are you coming to set that aside and say, all right, this isn't about me. This is about you. This is about what it is that you have done. It's about what you're going to do, and I'm going to worship you. And then what you have is, you have a group of people who are coming to find Christ. You have people who are coming to point to Christ, and you have a bunch of people that are coming all to worship Christ. And it's like, wow, that is what he is created. That is what he has designed. That is what he has intended. And that is magnificent. Absolutely magnificent. And so I'm going to invite the elders to come forward. We're going to enter into a time of celebrating what it is that Jesus was celebrating on that night that he took that cup and the bread and shared it with his disciples. So elders, come. So what we read in the scriptures, on the night It was Christ's last night before he was to be arrested and then crucified. He gathers with his disciples for this one last, they call it the Last Supper, they call it the Passover feast. And so they gather together in this upper room. And as Jesus is together with his friends, he's been ministering with them for about 3 years, and he's gathering with them, and he starts laying it out. They're there to celebrate this Passover. This is the fourth one now in this point in his life. They're there to celebrate the Passover. And part of this feast, it would have included bread and it would have included wine. And so Jesus, he takes the bread first and foremost. And it would have been unleavened bread, which meant it had no yeast in it. Because they also, when they celebrated that first Passover, they would use bread specifically without yeast because they were in such a hurry to get out of Egypt, they didn't have time to let the bread rise. And so they would make this unleavened bread, this bread without yeast in it, to remind them of God's goodness. And so he took the bread, Jesus did, and he broke it, and he gave it to his disciples, and he shared it with them. And they all knew the covenant with Abraham. They all knew the Mosaic covenant. And Jesus does something different, and he says, hey, guess what, guys? This is the covenant, this new covenant that's found in my body, which is about to be broken. I'm laying down myself for something new. I'm laying down myself. You know, and I think of the story where Jesus is engaged in conversing with the woman at the well. And as he's conversing with the woman at the well, he makes this comment because she asked, well, where is the right place to worship? The Jews say I'm supposed to worship here. The Gentiles say I'm supposed to worship here. The Samaritans say I'm supposed to worship here. And Jesus says, there's going to come a time where none of that matters, where Jews and Gentiles together will come together and worship. And we are living in that today. Because there's some of us who have come maybe seeking the Lord. There's some of us who have come and our job is to point people to God. And in all of it, we're here to worship together.